You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Live across Wisconsin on Civic Media, you're listening to Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, powered by Up North News. Now, from our Lake Wissota studio, here is the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Hey, good morning. It's 7:06. Welcome back. Nice to have you here up north on a Wednesday morning, September 24th, 2025. Parker Olson producing things down in Madison, and meteorologist Brittany Merlot standing by as well. Coming up, we will have the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Dr. Jill Underley, joining us for our weekly homeroom segment. She recently gave her annual State of Education address at the state capitol, and will be talking to us more about that in our next half hour. And we have Brittany's forecast coming as well. But as you know, this week we've brought back one of our Text to Win contests. It is time for today's first round of the Go for the Green and Gold Text to Win contest. Yes, green and gold. You'll get cash and jewelry for the prize of the day. Of course, you need the Civic Media app. Look up a station. Use the text button. For the 7 a.m. hour here, once I give you the word, you will have until 8 a.m. to text it. There will be seven chances throughout the day, each with different keywords. So seven chances to enter each day. Of all of the day's entries in this multi-state, multi-station game, one lucky winner is going to get $200 cash and a gold-plated chain. And then one really lucky winner for the whole enchilada will get the grand prize, two club-level indoor seats to see Green Bay versus Minnesota play some football. It's a Green Bay home game on November 23rd. There's a gas card to get you to the game as well. Total value of the grand prize package is more than $1,500. Now, the first time you enter, you are likely going to get a return message giving you a way to earn another entry linked to a specific activity like signing up for a newsletter. Winners will be contacted by Civic Media within five business days, first by text message. Full contest rules at the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us. All right, if you got all that, then I can give you the new keyword for this hour until 8 o'clock. The word is morning, like morning of the day, M-O-R-N-I-N-G, morning, M-O-R-N-I-N-G. You get till 8 o'clock to text that, and then you've got another chance in the 9 a.m. hour with Jane and Greg for Matt and Air on Air, and then throughout the day for the Go for the Green and Gold Text to Win contest. Again, the keyword is morning. All right, Brittany's here now, and we have another foggy morning here on Lake Wissota. What the advisory is where? Just basically the northwestern portion of Wisconsin, right, Brittany?
Yeah, it pretty much goes from Winona, Eau Claire, all the way up towards Hurley, and then everything north and west of that line, you're in the dense fog advisory, but there's still fog creeping into places northeast as well. So Minocqua, Eagle River, you're still seeing that. But it is pretty thick, especially north and west, huh, Pat?
Yeah,
you can see far.
It is. I mean, I can't take the pontoon out right now. I just couldn't see where I'd end up on the golf course across the way. So
that would be eerie.
Yeah, we need a little sunshine or something. What you got in store for us?
I got a little bit as we go later on throughout the day. More and more will peak out. Further south in the state, though, you're going to have to wait maybe until tomorrow to see more sunshine. You do have a chance for some spotty sprinkles on occasion. But no heavy rain or anything like that. It would just be a sprinkle here or there. So less clouds later in the day. We're looking at breezy winds out of the north today. A beach hazard statement, too, from Milwaukee through Racine and Kenosha. Those waves are building up about 3 to 6 feet out there. So not a good beach day. And temperatures right now, about 55 or so to 60 degrees for a majority of us. It is mostly cloudy, and we will make it today to the mid-60s to about 70 degrees. So slightly cooler today than the past few days. Then we start our warm-up tomorrow. Slow at first, but it really bumps up as we go into the weekend and next week. So tomorrow, a few mid to upper 70s scattered throughout the state. Friday, all of us hitting the upper 70s and then nearing 80 by Saturday. And then places south will be hitting 80 all throughout the weekend and into next week. A lot of places north flirting with that as well. And it's going to be dry and sunny, and you won't even need me for a little while because it's just going to be gorgeous. Mwah! Out there.
we'll need you. We'll take it. Yeah, just to remind us, keep reminding us how beautiful it is. Rob says, good morning from Tigerton, cloudy and 54. I have mowing jobs in Wittenberg today. One of the places where I mow in Wittenberg, Rachel's Roadside Bar and Grill, made it on YouTube's Best American Restaurants. I couldn't make it to the broadcast because I had to work. I mowed two huge yards in the rural areas of Tigerton with no cell coverage. Yesterday, it was a very beautiful day till the clouds came out in the late afternoon. No fog right now in Tigerton, just cloudy. But Brittany always brings sunshine anyway, regardless.
Oh, thanks, Rob.
And Tony, of course, being up in Ashland, talking about the green and gold contest. Forget the tickets to the football game. It's the gas card. He's like, you're going to pay for my gas too? That's like getting another ticket.
True.
which is true with what they're charging for gas to get from Ashland to Green Bay. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know if Tony can win, but all of his neighbors in the Ashland area, they could.
That's funny.
I want gas. I'll go. I don't even have to watch the game. You're giving me a gas card.
Somebody else can have the tickets.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, Tony then can give them away in his own way. But anyway, Brittany, thank you so much for the update. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We'll talk to you next hour. All right. Hey, remember, sign up for our newsletter, upnorthnewswi.com. At that point, you can see Ellie talking all about music. Turns out Ellie's a fan of some of the older music here, and some of us appreciate that very much. In fact, I like it so much, I think that starting next week in this time slot, we're going to bring Ellie on to talk more in person about what's in the newsletter. I think we've given her enough of a grace period, and we now need to subject her to this radio show. And so look for that starting next week. But she's busy working on not just, you know, getting used to the new digs and everything, but she's working on a special fall edition of the newsletter that'll come out this Friday. It's all about fall festivals and Oktoberfests, and get ready for some spooky sights as we get closer to Halloween. So, I mean, if you're looking for ideas for weekend road trips or things right in your community, go get signed up for the newsletter, upnorthnewswi.com. Click subscribe up in the banner at the top of the homepage. And while you're doing that, sign up for Civic Media's new daily newsletter. For that, you got to take your browser over to Substack, specifically civicmediatoday.substack.com, and get the best of all the shows. Of course, you could also take the shows with you. And to do that, well, go over to Spotify while you're doing all the surfing. Just get it all done. Get over to Spotify, follow this show and all of your other favorite Civic Media shows. And that way you're never going to miss anything from what we do throughout the course of the day here on Civic Media and at Up North News. Speaking of Up North News and over on our Facebook page, we were looking at, you know, some of the posts and, you know, monitoring some of the comments, because every so often you get a troll in the comment section, and we got somebody in the comment section. I don't know that he would consider himself a troll, but he does a lot of trolling out there. That'd be Derek Van Orden. That's right. The congressman jumped into our comment section about a story that we did late last week about all of the threats that he's making to people's employment and threats to cut federal funding to like entire cities, like Eau Claire, like the entire Mayo Clinic system, because he doesn't like what some people said about the Charlie Kirk murder. And he wants to equate it to domestic terrorism. And I wish I was kidding, but I'm not. And so when we noted in our article, you know, the ways that what Derek Van Orden is doing runs counter to the First Amendment, he got in our comment section and he said the following: not all speech is protected speech. 18 U.S. Code subsection 2331. Look it up. We will not be sending money to organizations or municipalities that keep people on their payroll who advocate for domestic terrorism. For people who advocate for domestic terrorism. That's what he thinks when people put up posts that indicate that they were not fans of Charlie Kirk. So as for that citation that he he made. We just put up a post. You can find it on our social media sites where we correct the record. We note that in the U.S. Code, Chapter 18, Section 2331, Paragraph 5, does indeed outline domestic terrorism. It covers activities that are dangerous to human life, or try to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, or influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. We read it again, did not see anything in there about social media posts that make a congressman angry as somehow defining domestic terrorism. In fact, that law that Van Orden cites does not designate domestic terrorism as a crime. It defines domestic terrorism so that people can be charged with other crimes like murder and hate crimes and weapons violations. But by Derek Van Orden's logic, countless free speech posts seem to him to, quote, advocate for domestic terrorism and could be punished by the government. And so we ask people to get in the comment section and tell us, do you agree with him that when people were criticizing Charlie Kirk or simply echoing his words back, is that not protected speech? Because Derek Van Orden said, not all speech is protected speech. And he's right about that part of it. There is hate speech. There's the, you know, yelling fire in a crowded theater type of speech as well. But posting on social media that he didn't like Charlie Kirk, and it leads to, I mean, perhaps 1,000 posts by now from Derek Van Orden. In fact, the Washington Post took note of it. They have a new article this morning, co-written in part by Patrick Marley, who was at the Journal Sentinel for a long time. And the Washington Post article focuses on a teacher in Ellsworth, Krista Lysecki, who was looking at the coverage about Charlie Kirk and grew exasperated because not enough was being made of the horribly racist and hateful things that he said. She tapped out a Facebook post about it, and it was where we actually first saw Derek Van Orden threatening to cut all funding to the city of Ellsworth unless this teacher was fired. Well, she has been suspended with pay, and she's waiting to find out if she will be fired or otherwise disciplined. And she told the Washington Post, people are upset that people wanted to silence Charlie Kirk, but they're not upset that I'm being silenced. I may not be proud of what I said, but it was my right to say it. And that is really what it comes down to. And it's the point Jimmy Kimmel was making yesterday as well when he came back on air, was that the First Amendment works best, works to its utmost, when it protects speech that you don't like, that you don't agree with. That doesn't make it domestic terrorism. That doesn't even make it hate speech. It's simply something that you didn't like. Might make you outraged, but as long as you don't instigate violence or government threats as a result of it, then the First Amendment is doing what it's supposed to do. So Derek Van Orden can get as snooty as he wants with reporters, as he has. He can get as confrontational in comment sections. He can use all the cuss words that he wants. And he does, and he can cite a specific chapter, section, and paragraph of the U.S. Code about domestic terrorism, but he said, read it. Well, we did. It doesn't cover social media posts that make a congressman get his fee-fees all hurt. Still to come, we'll be talking to the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jill Underley. I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
We are getting near the end of the regular season for the Milwaukee Brewers, but thankfully there will be some postseason action as well. But as for the regular season, well, there's a three-game series starting in San Diego tonight. then tomorrow night, Wednesday afternoon, a day off on Thursday, then a homestand against the Cincinnati Reds Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Then that does it for the regular season. Tonight's game against San Diego, the pregame coverage begins at 8:05 on several Civic Media stations. Head over to the website to learn more. And while you're there, check out, again, the details on the Go for the Green and Gold Text to Win contest, which we'll be doing in the 7 o'clock hour throughout this week and next week, where, again, with that Civic Media app, you're going to text in a keyword, and that'll get you entered for a big grand prize, tickets to see Green Bay versus Minnesota. It's a Green Bay home game, and you can get more details on the Go for the Green and Gold contest from Jane and Greg, part of Matt and Air on Air, coming up next here on the Civic Media Radio Network. The fall session of the legislature is getting going. We talked to State Senator Kelda Royce an hour ago. She's candidate for governor, and we talked about the package of education bills put forward by Democrats, the package of education bills put forward by Republicans. There's not a lot of common ground there. And unfortunately, it seems that even when there is a hint at common ground on something, there usually are some kinds of strings attached. And that appears to be the case with a different package of bills that Republicans are saying they'll introduce this week to deal with our elections, specifically absentee ballot drop boxes. Now, keep in mind that absentee ballot drop boxes were used for years in Wisconsin with no issues and with the support from both parties. Republicans really liked it because in rural areas, places with older populations, it was a matter of convenience. Democrats liked them in urban areas. Again, people who might have had busy schedules or young families. Again, they could drop off their ballots as securely as when you drop your mail off in the mailbox. All right? They're fine. They work. When Donald Trump knew he was going to lose the 2020 election to Joe Biden, and the documentation is there months before the election, he started laying the groundwork toward trying to steal the election, or at least to circumvent it or to cast doubt on its integrity. And one of the things that he flailed at was absentee ballot drop boxes. And then in the wake, for reasons I can only log as, quote, a cult of personality, unquote, suddenly so many Republicans didn't like absentee ballot drop boxes either. And there were court challenges, and there were conservative justices who said, yes, these things, it's like we just discovered them, and they're bad, and we have to get rid of them. Well, thanks to voters in Wisconsin, the state Supreme Court was put into progressive hands, and progressive justices looked at that and said, what are we talking about here? They work, they're fine, let them be. Let's turn to another matter, and then I'll bring the two together, and that is the processing of absentee ballots. Again, they're put into these envelopes. If you've ever filled one out, you know that you have to sign it. You have to get a witness to sign it. You have to put the address on there. Again, the ballot is sealed. You just know that there is an absentee ballot in there. And you either use the ballot drop box, or you mail it in, or you bring it back in person, or you fill it out in person at your local clerk's office. And then it goes into a box, goes into a locked box someplace until election day, when they're opened up. You have to check the addresses. You have to check to make sure the signatures are there and they're valid. And then you can open up the envelope. You can pull the ballot out, and then you can process them. Well, there's a lot of places, because they're big cities and there's only so much time and so many people and so many ballot counting machines, that in these larger cities, you have election results that don't come in until late at night. There's a way around that. And that would be to allow the absentee ballot envelopes to be checked the day before, make sure that they're good, toss out the ones that aren't. And that way, right away on election day, you can then just open them up, open up all the good ones, then you can run the ballots through the machine. That makes sense too, right? Right. So Republicans are now saying they're willing to go along with this. Well, that's nice of them. I mean, for the past couple of election cycles, we've known, Republicans and Democrats alike, that processing the absentee ballot envelopes the day before would be a good thing. And yet Republicans in the legislature have fought against that, have not supported it for only one reason. And it has nothing to do with security. It enables some of them to continue the talking point, basically the conspiracy theory that, well, if the ballots are taking so long to count and the results are coming in the middle of the night, there must be something shady going on in bad old Milwaukee or Madison or Green Bay or Racine or Kenosha. There must be something that we can't trust there. But they won't, of course, pass the bill that would allow the processing of the absentee ballot envelopes so that you wouldn't have that talking point. Well, now we come to Republicans saying that this week, here comes a new package of election bills, and it would allow for Monday processing of the absentee ballots. Well, thank goodness. And it would allow, for widespread use of absentee ballot drop boxes. Well, yeah, there should be. But of course, here come the strings. And there are definitely strings attached to this, as explained yesterday on Upfront by Republican Representative Scott Krug, who is vice chair of the Assembly Elections Committee. And he said on the program, I think it's fair to say that some of these things, Republicans might not like them and Democrats might not like some of the things. Well, I don't know. There's definitely things for most people to not like in terms of the strings that are attached, because we're now suddenly treating absentee ballot drop boxes like they're Fort Knox, that just waiting to be robbed or something. Because in return for Republicans supporting the Monday processing of absentee ballot envelopes, the bills include security changes for the drop boxes, including 24-hour video surveillance that must be live streamed on a municipality's website. So in other words, these cash-strapped local governments, whether it's a little township or a big city that's already having a tough time meeting expenses because of cuts by the state legislature, would now have to put 24-hour video cameras on the drop boxes and then reconfigure your websites to live stream a picture of a Dropbox, which, I'm sorry, you're begging for people to just go to these Dropboxes and put on a little theater presentation because they know they have an audience there. It serves no other role whatsoever. But wait, there's more. The ballots, according to this bill, would also need to be transferred from the drop box to a storage facility only under the constant supervision of a law enforcement officer. That's how little respect they have for law enforcement. I mean, you've already got police departments and sheriff's departments that they too are cash strapped. They too have better things to do. And yet the Republicans in the legislature would require that there be an officer or more to go to these drop boxes when these ballots are picked up. So let me ask you this. Are you aware of any mailboxes out there that are live streamed, that have 24-hour video surveillance, and that they're on the U.S. Postal Service website? No, because it doesn't happen. You know why? Because mailboxes are secure, and if you fiddle around with them, if you try to commit some kind of mail fraud or theft, that's a crime. You'll be charged with a crime. The same goes for absentee ballot drop boxes right now. If you monkey around with them, it's a crime. And who's going to take the risk of that to affect what? The 10 ballots that might be inside that box? But we're going to add a law enforcement officer that's got to be there like you're transferring gold bars. These are the strings that are attached in order to get Monday processing of absentee ballot envelopes. Why? Why can't we just have a clean bill? Why can't we ever just have a clean bill, an up or down vote? Are you okay with Monday processing of absentee ballots? If you're not, say so. Say you want to continue the conspiracy theory about late night ballot counting. But don't tie these strings. And then, of course, when they get voted down because they're ridiculous, they then get the talking point of, oh, the Democrats, they voted no on it. The Democrats voted no on election security. Yeah, they voted no on armed guards. I mean, why didn't you just ask for an armored car to be there to carry the ballots in as well? Maybe a full police motorcade. But always the strings and always the talking point, rather than just doing what is best and most efficient for our elections. And so my hope is, and my expectation is, that if these bills actually make it to the floor, and frankly in the committee process as well, the Democrats will put up amendments that would strip out the ridiculousness. Maybe even find some other kind of middle ground, whatever it may be, whether it's strengthening the penalties that already exist for monkeying with absentee ballot drop boxes or something else. But get us to the point where we can do the Monday processing. Have some more respect for your local clerks. Have some more respect for your local law enforcement. And stop making them engage in all of this performative politics, so that you can continue talking points rather than having elections that just do what they already do here. They are safe, they are fair, they are efficient, and in the ways that they could be made better, just make them better and stop screwing around with them. Oh, but speaking of screws, how's that for a transition? The headline from the New York Times: Trump's tariffs are damaging America's biggest foreign source of screws. Taiwan has long been a top provider of screws to the United States, but the factories are struggling to survive because of Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum. Most people know Taiwan as making all the semiconductors and other electronics. It's a lot of intricate work, but then there's that everyday, essential, almost invisible component of everyday objects, writes the New York Times, screws. But Taiwan screw makers are wondering how their businesses will survive over the next few months. And to what degree will China gain ground in the meantime? Because again, it's not like this is going to be creating American jobs. We're not opening up some kind of new markets for American screw makers. Okay? These are tiny things that are best made overseas more cost effectively. But now they won't be. Along with everything else that is more expensive, now think of the things that require lots and lots of screws. At Courier Newsroom, we've had a video series for a time. I'm not sure if the person still does it or not, but this would be a perfect episode for it, talking about the things that you don't normally see in politics but are working against you, the ways that you're being nickeled and dimed. Instead, the name of the series is You're Probably Getting Screwed. And in this case, it is quite literal. So again, a story in the New York Times, one of the many ways that a made-up trade war is hurting rather than helping our economy. Some final news and notes from Lake Wissota and a preview of Matt and Air on Air with Jane Matt and Air coming up in just a bit. I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back. A reminder that our Go for the Green and Gold Text to Win contest is going on this hour. And the key word for this hour is morning, M-O-R-N-I-N-G, like the morning part of the day. Text morning using the Civic Media app before 8 a.m. and you will be in the running for a daily prize, which is $200 and a gold-plated chain. See, green and gold. And also in the running, every entry is in the running for the grand prize, which includes tickets to a Green Bay versus Minnesota game in Green Bay, playing a little football in the month of November, and a gas card to get you there. Again, details at the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us. But morning is the keyword to text before 8 o'clock. And then your next chance to win, and there are 7 chances every day, your next chance to win 9 a.m. hour on Matt and Air on Air with Jane Matt and Air. Time for our weekly homeroom segment where we talk about public education, opportunities, and threats. And the threats are out there, but there are people who are willing to lead and call them out And one of those folks is the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jill Underley, who joins us this morning in the wake of her annual State of Education address delivered last week. Well, Jill Underley, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning to you too, Pat. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. It's so nice to have you here today. I mean, you've seen the headlines in the coverage of your remarks. And so we're going to start there. I mean, there are definitely issues that are internal to education in Wisconsin, but there's some real external pressure, and it's reflected in headlines that had you taking note that the biggest schoolyard bully that Wisconsin schools face right now is our own federal government, is the Trump administration. It's a, you know, it's a very assertive thing to say. Tell folks why that was a central part of your remarks.
Yeah, well, so the overall message from the State of Education address is that Wisconsin public education is a living story. It's written daily by students, educators, and communities. The themes in the State of Education were about belonging, love, community, pride in our communities. And what we're seeing right now is that the federal government is really trying to destroy that, right? They're taking away funding for teachers. They're taking away funding for special education students. The one that was in the headlines was students who are deafblind. They've threatened funding for school nutrition, programs in our schools. And so it's just really, they are the ones that are really causing a lot of chaos, I think, and uncertainty in our schools. Schools are wondering, are they going to get this money? And at the Department of Public Instruction, we're left to navigate that and stand up, you know, for our school districts, which is what we'll do anyway. But the federal government is really inserting themselves into the everyday operations of our schools and really threatening the good work that our schools are doing.
Especially for a group that says that all the time that they're looking to give education back to the states, they sure seem to find ways to continue to micromanage or to interfere. And you touched on one of them that really got my attention yesterday as Up North News reporter Selena Heller was working on this story about how under Trump, the U.S. Department of Education is canceling funding that would go toward the Wisconsin Deafblind Technical Assistance Program. And why is it being endangered like this? Because it falls under Donald Trump's definition of DEI, that you're singling out a group for help. In this case, children who are deaf and blind. Talk more about the program and its value, as well as the assertion that there's something divisive apparently about this.
Well, that's just it. It's just so arbitrary. I think, you know, when they were going through these programs, they're just doing a find and search, you know, in the grants for anything that mentioned diversity or inclusion or equity. And the deafblind community, I mean, it's a very specific population, very vulnerable population, very specialized when it comes to instruction. And when you look at special needs or you look at the deafblind community, you know, as an example. I mean, what we do in public education is we try to ensure that every human has an opportunity to be included and belong in their communities. And so we provide specialized training. We provide, you know, this grant money, provide specialized instruction, but also training for the teachers, materials, I mean, Braille. So it's really just disheartening, and rather it's just cruel, to be honest, that they're doing this to our communities. I mean, they're just ripping things apart that we have spent time building and investing in over the years.
Well, we've had politicians doing that at the state level for some time as well. We're talking to Jill Underley, Wisconsin Superintendent of Public Instruction, and you focused on that about pulling resources away from our public schools in order to fund the private voucher scheme that's going on and is taking up, you know, it's getting mighty close to a $1 billion price tag that I still think plenty of taxpayers around Wisconsin don't know about. What they know is that there are these referendums. All the time, these referendums, and you have some politicians that are painting the school districts as being greedy and having to raise taxes. And it feels like you're the one connecting the dots, saying there's a reason for these referendums, and it's not any kind of selfishness on the part of your local school board.
Yeah, I think people are starting to put it together. I mean, because the money is, you know, the money that the legislature puts in every year, you know, it is pie. I mean, if you want to think about it that way, it's just that the piece of the pie that goes to privatization just keeps getting larger. So therefore, even though the money might appear that, you know, the legislature is putting more money in every year, it's just that the portion that goes to our public school districts is getting smaller. And I do feel people are putting it together. I'm seeing a lot of signs of hope, you know, like, for example, like in the Green Bay area, they were able to put it on their tax bills, you know, how much money was going to private schools from their tax, from their property tax. So, I mean, I know people want this information on there. And my hope is that, you know, in the next few years, if the legislature is able to, you know, get more gains with more public school advocates in the legislature, that this will be on everybody's tax bill. It's just transparency is so important in government. And I do see some signs of hope there.
As we talk about moving from the, you know, the 30,000 foot level of federal funds and state funds into the classroom itself, current practices, technology, teaching methods, everything else, when you look at that part of the state of education in Wisconsin, are there things there that need particular investment, that need more of a focus than they've been getting these days, that where Wisconsin kids might risk falling behind if we're not funding, you know, something to its proper level, or not keeping our teachers trained or anything like that? Where are those opportunities?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. So as you're probably aware, but maybe your listeners are not, we did undergo a strategic planning process over the past couple of years, and we listened to people throughout Wisconsin about what they want in their public schools. And so we came up with four different pillars, and the one that I'll talk about right now, I mean, is the innovative education. We really need to start preparing kids for their future and not our past. I mean, when you think about how school is done in many ways, it's still done the same way as it was 50 to 100 years ago. And so we really need to start looking at innovation. We need to look at how we're able to meet students where they are and where they're going to go. I mean, technology is moving so fast right now, and we need to expand, you know, personalized learning and competency-based learning in our schools. We need to use career pathways to our advantage. We need to improve access to learning opportunities and library resources. And our goal is to prepare kids for their future. We're also looking at educator recruitment and retention. We know that the number one indicator of a child's success in school when they're in the school is the quality of their teacher. And when we have, you know, this turnover with our teachers, when we are struggling to fill high need areas like math and science and global languages and special education, that's hurting kids. And that's hurting our future, you know, not just our economy, but I mean, just these humans, you know, their future. So we have to really look at and agree that strong schools need strong educators. And we know that we need to expand access to grow your own programs. We need to improve teacher compensation, mentorship, professional development. But going back to the federal aspect, this is an area that they are really leaning in on cutting funding for, is our educator workforce.
It also sounds like people in the legislature, certain folks have wanted to stress standardized tests and the method of scoring and tracking that. There's been some back and forth in the legislature about that. How would you describe the current standardization test and grading process? Are there still changes that need to be made compared to where we are right now?
Yeah, I think that was the interesting criticism, I think, about my state of education. Is just that the speech was about, you know, belonging and community pride and the things that we need to do to make our schools stronger. And the opposition or the people who criticize it really are like, well, you know, she's just lowering standards. The thing is, it's like the test is just a one point in time. And it's always undergoing review. When you look at our standards are updated every 7 years, and it's not the same ones every year. So it's like, you know, math is done 1 year, literacy is another year, science is another year. And so it's like the test is constantly undergoing changes. And so you do have to update the metrics. And so it's, you know, that's one piece of it. But then the other piece of it is our school report card, our school and district report cards, which were put into place 15 years ago. And they're in state statute as far as what, you know, is measured. And so we did look at that for the first time in 15 years, and just to make sure that things are on track. It's kind of like when your computer undergoes an update, it always seems like, oh, it's at the worst time, or your phone has to download an update. But that's what we did with the state and district report cards. It's like it was due to get an update and just make sure everything was aligned. But again, it's just one piece of information. We've got lots of other indicators, you know, of the health, I suppose, of our public schools.
And finally, you were recently elected to a second four-year term. There's going to be a change in the governor's office, one way or another, a brand new governor. We right. won't know the makeup of the legislature, but with you being freshly elected, you're certainly positioned to be the most I guess fearless advocate is the right way. You've got the job security, essentially. How do you see your role over the next 4 years, the public-facing part of your role?
Look, I have never shied away from saying what I need to say or what needs to be said when it comes to public schools. I mean, that's always been my, you know, I guess just one of my characteristics, right? And so what I'm going to continue to do is just continue to advocate for public schools. I'm going to continue to advocate for the things that I know work. You know, when we look at child development and we look at success academically, I mean, I talked about, you know, teachers and them being the number one indicator for academic success, but there's a lot more that goes into it, you know, school nutrition, making sure kids have access to mental health, but also health, medical health as well, and dental health too. And we also need to just continue to modernize our public education system. So I'm going to continue to speak out in favor of all of those.
Dr. Jill Underly, we've run out of time, but it was so nice to hear all about the state of education. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Pat.
All right. Much more in the 8 o'clock hour ahead of Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, powered by Up North News on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Hey, just a reminder, I sit here from 6 until 9 a.m. weekday mornings. You don't have to. We'd love to have you along for the full 3 hours, 5 days a week. If you can't, well, all the more reason to pod this little program. Head over to Spotify and follow our show, or do so at Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. And that way you never miss a guest, you never miss an update, you never miss a quip. And that includes topics like healthcare. And we're going to discuss that right now with our guest, Catherine Hempstead from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We're going to talk about, you always hear us talking about, you know, the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare kind of at this very overarching umbrella of healthcare, et cetera. We're going to get into kind of the nitty gritty of it. What is it that makes it more affordable? And why is that a bit of a political football lately as we talk about, you know, the federal budget and things like that? Catherine Hempstead, good morning. Nice to have you here again.
Hi, Pat. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to see you. And for telling us more, we're going to get into specifically these healthcare tax credits. It's tax credits that really kind of put the affordable in the Affordable Care Act. So why don't we kind of go back to when the earth cooled here and explain how these tax credits, how these subsidies, how they are essentially are the foundation of the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. That's a great question. The Affordable Care Act was designed to help fill a really important gap in our healthcare system, which was to provide affordable coverage to people who didn't get an offer from their employer, weren't old enough for Medicare, didn't have low enough income for Medicaid. So they sort of updated, improved, re-regulated the individual market and required insurers to accept everyone, no underwriting for medical conditions, rating only for age. And the, you know, to make that actually work for people, to make the coverage be affordable, they also included this set of tax credits that were based on income. And it, you know, it was an amazing accomplishment and filled a really important gap, but there was definitely the perception that the tax credits were not sufficient to make coverage as affordable as people wanted. So for example, when you reached 400% of the poverty level, which is only about $62,000 annual income for a person, so it's you know, not a very high income, you actually would hit what people call the subsidy cliff. You wouldn't get any tax credit at all. So coverage was really unaffordable for people at that income level and over. And for people with really low income, there was also the perception that the tax credits were not really sufficient, and a lot of people were not taking the offer of coverage. So in 2021, they enhanced the tax credits. They made them more generous, and they also eliminated that subsidy cliff and just had a cap of a percent of income that you would be required to spend on premiums, so that that kind of smoothed that top part of the income distribution and made the coverage a lot more affordable for people at the lower end of the income distribution. And as a result, in every state in the country, enrollment really soared. Like, for example, in Wisconsin, you went from close to 200,000 people in 2020 to about 313,000 in 2025. So that's like a 50% bump up in your enrollment in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. And those kinds of results were seen all over the country, and enrollment in the marketplace soared to like 24 million. But the reason I'm on the show today and the reason we're talking about it is that those enhanced credits are set to expire at the end of this year, unless Congress takes action. And, you know, as you probably know, open enrollment is going to start soon for the 2026 plan year. And that plan year is going to reflect the end of those tax credits unless something happens.
So you had those expiring, and then to add insult to injury, you had the massive cuts to Medicaid and other things that made life more affordable for Americans in the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. And now it comes time to pass a new federal budget for the new fiscal year. Republicans most likely need Democratic votes in order to pass that. And Democrats are saying, well, in return for our vote, here are some things that we would like to see restored or extended. And so when you look at what they're talking about, I don't know if I should ask best case scenario or the most realistic good scenario that could happen between now and next week that would be beneficial to most Americans in keeping their health care affordable. Is it just focusing on those enhanced tax credits and restoring those?
I think that's the most feasible thing that's on the table right now. You did mention some other like looming threats to coverage that are going to impact people in the Medicaid program, you know, work requirements and some really important changes that affect how states are able to finance the program and pay providers. And there are, you know, lots and lots of concerns about what those things are going to do to coverage. And in fact, you know, CBO is estimated kind of all in, maybe 15 million Americans are going to become uninsured over the next 10 years, which is something like a 50% increase in the size of the uninsured population. So it's a massive assault on health insurance coverage, you know, when you look at all the pieces. But I think the thing that is, you know, closest to really, you know, hitting the road and being enacted is this situation with the enhanced premium tax credits. And that's what people are trying to incorporate into, you know, budget discussions in Congress. And certainly there have been talks about a permanent extension. There have been talks about a one-year extension. There have been talks about a two-year extension. I mean, right now, unfortunately, the parties are not talking to each other at all, it seems. At least that's what the public face of it is. So it's very, very difficult to, you know, suss out what might be happening.
Our guest is Catherine Hempstead from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and we're talking about the enhanced tax credits that helped folks afford health insurance through the Affordable Care Act and them expiring or potentially being extended. And I like the point that you made that there's talk about making them permanent or maybe for another year or two. Obviously, what was approved in 2021 is expiring now. Why was it set up that way? Because like in all things, politics is the art of the possible. And there were plenty of people in 2021 who figured that by 2025, they would see how many more people are being helped by those enhanced tax credits, how much more affordable health insurance has become for more Americans, and that they would then see that and want to make it permanent. Obviously, that's not what we're seeing proposed by the Trump administration or by congressional Republicans. But Catherine, there's no shortage of either anecdotes or mentions in news stories that there are individual Republican members of Congress who have indicated they would be open to extending or maybe even making permanent the enhanced tax credits because they understand the help. They also understand the harm going into an election year of saying that these credits were allowed to expire. But I'm wondering if you get the same sense that there are more than zero, you know, individual Republicans in Congress who might be amenable to extending these healthcare tax credits and avoiding a shutdown next year.
I think that's definitely right. And there have been a number of individual members who have said they're open to talking about it. There's been some proposals from Republicans, you know, of maybe a 1 or a 2 year extension. So I think you're right. And the truth is that states that voted Republican are really, in general, as a rule, have disproportionately higher use of the ACA marketplace, especially some of the states that haven't expanded Medicaid, which I know is partially true in Wisconsin, but states like Texas and Florida are really dependent on the marketplace, and they're going to see massive disruptions and coverage loss if these tax credits go away. So I think there's a lot of concern in all members of Congress, but I think especially a lot of Republican members, that their constituents are going to experience really massive sticker shock when they start to see what they're going to be asked to pay for coverage. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people are going to drop coverage, and that's going to create a spiral of bad consequences for individuals, for hospitals, healthcare providers, you know, everybody. So I do agree with you that there is a lot of interest from some individual members, Republicans and certainly Democrats, in trying to come to an agreement.
We were talking in the last hour about a New York Times article that cited Republicans who were pointing to the cost of all of these enhanced tax credits and citing that big price tag as a reason to oppose their renewal. But what was missing from there was the comparison, the contrast with what's the cost if suddenly all of those people can't afford their health insurance anymore, either have to pay a lot more and decide to drop it or just are no longer eligible? And I don't know that that's a number you have at your fingertips. But again, I would imagine the cost of extending these tax credits probably pales in comparison to the long range cost of having that many more million Americans go back to being uninsured.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's also worth noting that, you know, this is the only tax credit that didn't get extended, you know. So when you think about what was in the reconciliation bill, which included a lot of extensions of tax credits and then some really drastic cuts, historic cuts to the Medicaid program, and then you see this, it seems like there's a real concerted effort to undermine health insurance coverage in recent policy. And to your point, yes, it costs money to cover people, but it's also very costly when people aren't covered, because you see people neglect symptoms because they are terrified of having medical debt or not knowing what they might be asked to pay if they go into the hospital or clinic and they don't have coverage. So people neglect symptoms until they're much more serious, then they show up in more expensive settings like emergency rooms. And unfortunately, sometimes it's too late for things to be treated. And there've been a lot of great studies of the health benefits of expanding coverage. And unfortunately, we we kind of know what's going to happen when you throw that process into reverse, which is something that I think we're really looking at in this country from a multiple set of sources. And then you also see, you know, the consequence on the healthcare system when people lose customers that can come in and pay for preventive care or for elective surgery or for things that improve the quality of their life, but they won't do if they don't have coverage. Then you see some hospitals, especially in rural areas, becoming very financially stressed, maybe having to lay people off, maybe having to eliminate certain specialties. And then that has a spillover effect on the health and access to healthcare for the entire community, especially in rural areas when there may not be a lot of healthcare systems. So you're right, there is a real negative ripple effect when people lose coverage. And it's also not just people's health and not just the healthcare system, but health insurance coverage is a really important form of financial protection. So when people go into debt or people have big medical bills to pay, they stop paying other bills. They may not pay their rent. They may not pay their credit card bills. And so you see a sort of a downward spiral in people's financial well-being too. So it's extremely costly to not cover people.
Catherine Hempstead is with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, helping explain this very important part of keeping affordable in the Affordable Care Act and some of the background on what may lead to a government shutdown fight next year, or next week rather, when Congress is back in session. Catherine, thank you again. It's always great to get background from you. Hope you have a great day.
Thanks, you too. Pleasure.
All right. Yep. Take care now. All right. Some final news and notes from Lake Wissota coming up here. And again, a reminder, tomorrow we'll have some of our regular Thursday guests here. That'll include Joe Zepecki. It'll include Sean O'Malley talking about your money and the markets as well. All that ahead. For more information, of course, you can always head to civicmedia.us, click shows to learn more, look for our back issues of shows, or subscribe to us as a podcast. Head over to Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Back in just a bit. You're up, North.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.